This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
The following paper was given by Professor Michael Ambrosi of the University of Trier for the Robinson College PIGU mini conference on the 29th of November 2013.
Okay, yeah. The instruction was that I should be rather short, and it is work in progress. I returned to the topic of Keynes and PIGU now with a different accent. What I really have trotted through is, of course, PIGU's theory of unemployment. Mm-hmm. And then I also published a little article on his offer curve analysis of the labor market, which he inherited from Marshall, and which amusingly he wrote together with Keynes in 1905. And they took some mistakes which Marshall had and admitted, especially that he took the utility of money as one of the arguments. And later on, Robbins changed this, that he took the utility of goods as it should be, as the counterpart to the labor supply. My topic is the question: what happened to the Cambridge School of Economics, and which role did PIGU and Keynes play in its downfall? Now, the question is whether there was a downfall, and I quote a few voices that, or one voice of Maria Marcuzzo and others, that Cambridge changed from a school to a place of economics. The Cambridge School of Economics was a deliberate creation of Alfred Marshall. He worked at it, with the stated intention to have a Cambridge school. He worked to have it in Cambridge. He worked in committees, and of course he worked as far as working out the theory is concerned. Now, Marshall's ideas were the common textbook, and in this tradition, one could imagine that the school went on, and it was perceived to be going on with PIGU as follower, as temporal follower, as following up on Marshall, and Keynes being the exponent in monetary matters in the discussion with the London School of Economics. It was mainly this juxtaposition, London School of Economics and Cambridge, which enlivened the academic discussion. And in the London School of Economics, there was Edmund Kennan. I think when you look at the biographies of the people who were under his influence, they praised him very much, and they were very much inspired by him. Now, Kennan was from Oxford, and he was a Smith specialist, and there was this nimbus, I think, well, I do not substantiate this, but I think there was this expression, impression that Cannon came from Smith and represented the truth of ancient times, and had common sense applications of this truth now in our time, or in his time. I think the relation between Cambridge and LSE via Cannon is very little reflected in the literature. I write a few indications that Cannon is always in the backdrop, but I think he is really prominent and the driving force. Now, the question is, what did Pigou do in order to further the image and the presence of Cambridge and keeping the Cambridge School together? David Collard wrote, he disliked committee work, and he rather had Keynes do the committee work. Actually, he disliked lecturing, and he did Keynes do lecturing. I think Skidelsky has a few passages where the father of Keynes said, "No, this is not right that young Keynes is constantly lecturing the introductory, the principles, and Pigou doesn't do this." So there was a little row between Keynes and Pigou on this matter, that Keynes was really taken as a representative of the basic education in economics. The question is now, where is the deficiency? Is it that Keynes willfully destroyed the school, or was it that were there some other reasons? Now, one other reason is that the marginal analysis of Alfred Marshall just became commonplace, and in this regard, you did not need a Marshall anymore, but all sorts of applications of Marshall. Now, one interesting thing is that Milton Friedman, of whom we just talked, that he refers in his ideas about methodology, that he refers to Marshall, and he is the one who says that actually we are all Marshallians now, indeed, he doesn't say it in these words, but words to that extent. And actually, his theory of the consumption function of temporary and permanent effects, that could very well have come from Cambridge on the basis of the theory of waiting, reinterpreted more or less as I reinterpreted it in interpreting Keynes. And I think it is a pity that this piece of Cambridge analysis was sort of given left to people like Friedman, and he got great credit for this. I skimmed the Joe Stiglitz book on the price of inequality, and well, of course, he's very critical of all the Chicago boys, but there is one thing for which Friedman rightfully deserved his Nobel Prize, and that is his consumption analysis. But I think that is really a pity. Now, of course, to invoke Friedman is maybe anachronistic when we talk about Pigou, but there is a parallel episode, and that is this with Robbins. Robbins, who took up this offer curve analysis of the labor market, and in this context, then he showed that in his Economics of Welfare, Pigou assumed a backward bending labor supply curve, so that when you tax labor, then that there would be more labor supply. And without qualification in that context, actually later on I read that passage, and there he refers really to workers who are on the edge of survival, and in all and they have to, if they get less for the hour, they have to work more in order to get their foodstuff. And then he writes, but in the long run, probably the supply is constant. Nevertheless, I think that was a very clever piece of Robbins. And the irony here is now that an instrument coming from Marshall is used as a critique for Pigou. And Pigou then writes, Robbins is right, but Pigou is misunderstood. Probably if you continue reading that passage in Economics of Welfare, then you see that he had a constant labor supply function. And I don't know, I have this passage from Horsen, Susan Horsen. Do I pronounce it right? She doesn't say why, or Pigou doesn't say why he feels misunderstood. So one of the reasons is maybe that this marginal analysis went global anyhow, but Cambridge could have done more in order to keep the analysis in a way which later on was taken up by others. Another thing is the monetary analysis. Now, the monetary analysis, there is a passage in Pigou who said that youngsters would not dare to engage in monetary analysis because they have the feeling or they knew that there is something even better either in the mind or in the desk of Marshall. And therefore they are intimidated, and he speaks of the bad effects of the dictatorship of Marshall. Mm-hmm. Pigou speaks of the bad effects of Oscar, of course, mainly about the good effects, but he weighs, as you said several times, is his way. And one of the outcomes of this debate about the Cambridge monetary theory is that they say, especially Robertson said, then the liquidity preference argument is in Marshall already in Cambridge School, you have, of course, you have the analysis from Levington, British Capital Markets, where he describes the liquidity, the demand for money as a result of marginal analysis. So you could see this in parallel to Keynes. And if that really is now in Cambridge already, the marginal analysis having the rate of interest, the demand for money, and the whole array of other assets, why did they not accept what Keynes had to write in this manner? The reason is that they were in conflict with the theory of weighting, with the theory of interest being determined through weighting, which comes back, of course, from Marshall, and there is a passage in Levington where he then expounds the theory of weighting, and there you see this discrepancy, this schizophrenia really which they have, and which then really is bridged by Keynes. I then have a section in the paper where I mention Keynes' flirtation with Malthus. First, Keynes was, of course, fascinated with thought convincing the population theory of Malthus, but then reworking his biographical sketch of Malthus, he stressed far more the theory of effective demand. And with this theory, he wants to claim him as really the first economist of Cambridge. There is a passage in Skidelsky, where he says, now this is the intention of a school building, which Keynes has with this invocation of Malthus. And I think one could see in this the attempt to redefine the Cambridge school, namely a combination with Malthus and Marshall. And maybe if some people would have followed Keynes on this road, Cambridge would still have its distinctive mark in this way. The question is, what is really the basic issue between Keynes and Pigou? And I think Pigou is still a relative price-oriented economist, and Keynes wants to change the paradigm to a new way of thinking, namely effective demand, that you push the economy not by calling out relative prices, but by calling out real turnover possibilities, which the entrepreneurs take up. They translate it then into relative prices and quantities, so that the moving element is this this turnover, this scalar value. It is not the vector of prices which moves the economy, but the demand. Maybe you can disaggregate the demand, but the demand as a price quantity, potential price quantity magnitude. And I think nobody in Cambridge really followed Keynes in this paradigmatic intention. Yes, I think I stopped there. It is work in progress, and so I stop with an open end. Mm. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. I mean, I'd like to take the liberty to actually respond, you know, in a more structured way to Michael's paper, because I only saw it a few days ago, I think. I can't really remember. Uh-huh. Life at Cambridge is so ridiculous. So I've not had a chance to write anything of equal weight, but I thought I would, rather than just ask questions, present a little view of my own. And as Michael points out, in 1978, in the very first edition of the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics, Joan Robinson wrote, "Sraffa 1960 wasn't published until 1960. Might have been started in 1928. But Sraffa had shown a draft to Keynes in 1928, and Keynes evidently did not make much of it, and Sraffa in turn did not make much of the general theory. It is the task of post-Keynesians to reconcile the two." This is the famous phrase. And this challenge was taken quite seriously for at least a decade, in particular through the Trieste Summer School, which ran, I think, from 1981 to 90, but ended in apparent failure. And several, let's call them post-Keynesian authors, I think little p and a hyphen, notably Sheila Dow and Stephen Dunn, have argued that the two approaches, Keynes's and Sraffa's, are incompatible. Whereas you have people like Gary Monjovi and Marc Lavoie who've argued that it's very dangerous for post-Keynesian economics to take a what Paul Davidson calls a small tent view. But on the other hand, Paul Davidson argues forcibly and, to my mind, reasonably convincingly, that a view shouldn't be called post-Keynesian if it's incompatible with Keynes. So it's quite a difficult, there's a number of contradictions there which fall into, which support your thesis that the idea of a school, you suggest a coherent body of thought, etc., and there's a lot of contradictions here. I'm actually going to come out in favour of Joan Robinson's view, somewhat to my surprise. Though here I'm following Keynes's rather than Sraffa's approach to the airing of half-formed, I hope not half-baked, ideas. So why bother? Why would we want to marry these two unlikely bedfellows? And first of all, what's the nature of the great divide? In a nutshell, it seems to me that it corresponds to the difficulty of reconciling equilibrium with uncertainty. And I recently wrote a paper on Keynes's State of Short-Term Expectation, which is in the Review of Political Economy, where I take apart Jan Kregel's definitive 1976 paper on expectation and equilibrium, definitive in the sense that that's where everything that has been the source of most of the literature. And since I've taken it apart, I've been waiting for the thunderbolt. But and in one sense, that paper is focused on a rather point of Keynesiology, as Michael would put it, which is, does Keynes assume in his exposition of the principle of effective demand that short-term expectations are fulfilled? Well, you'll say, well, who cares? You know? But the relevance of that paper to this, to Michael's paper, is that I argue that Keynes treats short-term and long-term expectations quite differently. So I suggest that Keynes adopts an assumption of what we would now call rational expectations in his analysis of the short term. He uses the term judicious foresight. But of course the long term is an entirely different matter. And therefore for me the principle of effective demand is a theory of the formation of short-term expectations. Okay, it's not about, nothing to do with disappointment of expectations and, you know, Keynesian crosses. It's about the formation of short-term expectations as a set of equilibrium prices determined by supply and demand. Right? Very Marshallian. And my key to unlocking the exegetic puzzle, what we find in the general theory, is the introduction of something that's not there, which is always unfortunate, but the introduction of a division of entrepreneurs, which are there in the general theory, very much so, into two categories, categories of employers and dealers. And that's, of course, a division of function that we observe all the time in the real world. And although I will never be able to prove beyond doubt that Keynes actually assumed this in the general theory, in my article I've cited considerable evidence from his discussion with Hawtrey about the draft of the general theory that this division was part of the common sense substrate of Cambridge thinking at the time, and this is where we start to connect. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify what I mean, when I say that short-term expectations are determined by supply and demand, what I mean is supply by employers of labour on the one hand and demand by dealers in goods on the other. So it's demand by dealers, not final demand by consumers, or indeed usually demand by ultimate investors in capital equipment. So this isn't a simple classical juxtaposition between preferences and technology. The problem that this construction addresses is time. It's production time. It can take a year from stuff to get from the field or the mine to the retail shelf. And Pigou is actually, he's got a lovely image, as you probably know, about the lake, likening capital to a lake. And although I think there's obviously big problems about treating capital as a homogeneous fluid, his concept of the importance of capital as, you know, capitalism is about production with capital means of, you know, with machines, if you like, or with, over a process of time. And Pigou has great insight. And Pigou and Keynes and Hawtrey, they're all reading off the same page. It's this employer-dealer thing, which I think is the chink through which I can see the way to make a link with Schraffer. Or amazed, I'm sure. But again, why would we need to bother? I mean, you know, why do we need to bother with Keynes and Strafford? And, I mean, I'd be the first to say that the general theory is a wonderful piece of work and Keynes was a genius. And I would also say that general theory is a work of theoretical precision, which is not something you hear very often. It's been seriously underestimated by friend and foe alike. And I argued in my 2006 book that in creating a Marshallian macroeconomics, which is what I described it as, an equilibrium of industry as a whole, I'm arguing there that Keynes addressed and actually overcame Strafford's 1926 criticism of the Marshallian theory of value. At least he did so at the theoretical level of logical consistency, which was Strafford's main point, that Marshallian economics was illogical. Yeah. So what I find interesting about the conversation we've had this afternoon is that Pigou too places the emphasis on factor substitution rather than the whole question of consumer, you know, the consumer preferences and comparisons of utility. And the general theory is very much a theory of the firm, really. You don't have the consumer, the formation of relative prices as, you know, comparative utilities. So you might say, why do we need Strafford? Well, I'd say it was because even the general theory has its limits. And in particular, Keynes admitted, as you remember the exchange with Dunlop and Tarshis and Kaletsky, he admitted that the empirical evidence on cyclical movements in the real wage called into question the foundations of the Marshallian theory of value. Okay, not just his theory, not just Keynes's theory, as Greg Mankiw likes to suggest, but Marshallian theory. So, and as we come to the point, I think the hallmark of the Cambridge school is not, as Michael suggests, an adherence to Marshall, but an aspiration towards an economic science in which theory can be confronted with evidence. And so Keynes was therefore seriously concerned by the findings, rattled, I think would be the word, by the findings of Dunlop, Tarshis and Kaletsky. The problem with the general theory is not that it contains no theory of value, which you hear occasionally, but that it contains a theory of value which does not correspond to the facts. So that's a criticism not only of Keynes, but of the entire edifice of marginalist economics within which he chose to cast the general theory, and of course marginalist economics effectively dominates modern economics. So the task of replacing marginalism was, of course, the life work of Piero Sraffer. And although he shares the fate of Keynes in being widely misunderstood, and Pigou, I suppose, his endeavour was, I think, to contribute to the production of a scientific theory of value, which avoids what he described as the descent into metaphysics represented by Marshall's attempt to build a science based on the measurement of motives. And there's some irony, therefore, in the fact that in the hands of his successors, at least in the view of their critics, Strafford's system has become associated with an ideal, timeless equilibrium position without any empirical counterpart, let alone any room for post-Keynesian concerns about expectations, short-term or long-term. And it was when I heard Man-Suk Park, I don't know if you know him at all, in Korea University, he's got a Cambridge background training. He gave a paper here at the Keynes seminar last year, and you can listen to it if you want, on the website. The penny dropped, and I grasped the synthesis, or the possibility of a synthesis, through a shared between Strafford and Keynes, through a shared recognition that long period does not mean long term, okay? And that the use of the term long run merely confuses matters even further. And long period refers to logical time, or some sort of process in logical time, and long term to historical time. This is what Joan Robinson's phrase. And Jeff Harcourt, as you know, argues for following Joan in understanding long period as an adjective rather than a substantive. It relates to an equilibrium process. And Garignani insisted that the long period or normal rate of profit is located in the present. And in the general theory, the long period position means the equilibrium employment that arises when the capital stock has fully adjusted to a given state of expectation, so that in Serafian or Kaletskian terms, the capital equipment is being utilised at its normal level. So Mansoup suggests that the Sraffa system of production prices refers to a fully adjusted position under the condition of free competition. Just referring, that is, even if prices determined in the Sraffa system are established and the economy is in free competition, there is no need for the economy to be actually in a fully adjusted position. This is pretty obscure. But the same question does arise in Marshall's system. Where do Sraffa's prices of production reside if they're not observable as market prices? Are they any less metaphysical than Marshall's normal prices? And I suggest Keynes's answer is clear. They exist in the minds of entrepreneurs. But that doesn't make them metaphysical. The decisions about production and employment that are made by firms on the strength of their expectations are perfectly concrete and observable. Expectation determines output and employment. And again, there's common ground there to some extent with Pigou. So the question for theory then remains, what determines the expectations and how can they be objective in the sense of the unique shared state of expectation to which Keynes constantly refers? And that's a theoretical problem that I've addressed in my other work, and it's too far from the focus of today to go into. But what I would suggest is that an understanding of the principle of effective demands in terms of the Keynes-Hawtrey employer-dealer framework can equally well accommodate the Sraffa price equations. Specifically, the dealer's orders that emerge from this system provide the exogenous quantities of output, heterogeneous output, that drive Sraffa's system. So Keynes's core insights are maintained, but they're based on the classical rather than neoclassical theory of value and distribution. So that's my view of where we might be. How do we define a school of economics then? And one view is as a body of settled traditional doctrine, and I think we all accept that Cambridge has not yet provided that. But I would suggest rather that the Cambridge school has been a way of thinking about the world, a work in progress, which it was perfectly consistent for it to reject marginalism, because marginalism did not conform to the facts, and that what Cambridge was interested in was building an economic science. Right now, it's winter in Cambridge, but you know, the tree may yet flower again. We shall see. So that's my attempt to make a link between post-Keynesian economics and Pigou.